This episode of Access Utah was first broadcast in August of last year.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today we're talking with the editors of an upcoming book, A Republic of Scoundrels, the schemers, intriguers, and adventurers who created a new American nation. Founding fathers such as George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, and Alexander Hamilton are often considered American saints, revered for their wisdom and self-sacrificing service to the nation. However, within the founding generation lurked many unscrupulous figures, men who violated the era's expectation of public virtue and advanced their own interests at the expense of others. They were turncoats and traitors, opportunists and con artists, spies and foreign intriguers. Some of the names are well-known, Benedict Arnold and Aaron Burr. Others are less notorious now, but were no less threatening then. The early years of the Republic were full of self-interested individuals, sometimes succeeding their plots, sometimes failing, always shaping the young nation. And we bring in the editors of this upcoming volume. David Head is Associate Lecturer of History at the University of Central Florida and a Distinguished Faculty Fellow in History at Kentucky Wesleyan College. Welcome to the program.
Well, thanks for having me here today. I'm delighted to be here.
We appreciate it. Timothy Hemis is Assistant Professor of History at Texas A&M University Central Texas. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom. Thanks for having us.
So let me start with Timothy Hemis. How did this project come about?
Good question. Well, I was working on another project in the archives and kept coming across names that just kept appearing, and names like James Wilkinson and George Morgan and Diego Gardocki and Aaron Burr, of course. We know who Aaron Burr was, and it just started to sit in the mind that there was something there, that there's a whole bunch of these characters that are lesser known. And then the pandemic hit, and I was thinking about an idea, and I threw it out on Twitter. Well, it's what, X now or whatever it is, but then it was Twitter, and put out a, hey, would anybody be interested in this project? And then it grew from there, and David contacted me, and we kind of built it together and got contributors and put it forth, and it became a book.
So. Yeah, and coming out later this year, I think.
Yeah, December 5th.
December 5th. Yep. So, David Head, what did you think of this idea? Had you been familiar with some of these figures?
Yes, I've heard of some of the bigger names, of course. I've been kind of working in similar figures. I've written about pirates and privateers in the early 19th century. So guys who had a somewhat complex relationship with the law and legitimacy has been a part of my work for a while. So in this, guys in that world I had kind of been working on. So when Tim put this idea out there, I was like, huh, there's something there. I mean, I've seen a lot of these guys, and he named some figures I'd never heard of. But I had kind of sensed that even if we hadn't remembered them today, they were still guys who could have been a real pain for some of the officials, the guys we have heard of in the new government in the United States. So I had a sense that, yeah, there was something here. It was an important story. And it's interesting the way the kind of the intellectual part of the story comes together with the practical. Tim had mentioned the pandemic, which made it difficult to do research, and you know, everybody's kind of at home all the time. And I had kind of been looking for a project that I could do without a lot of travel, that could be done with on a schedule that was conducive to my schedule with, you know, having three little kids and all that kind of thing. I couldn't really travel. So the idea of editing a volume and recruiting contributors, that experts on particular people who had already done this kind of research before in their careers, and they had it on hand, that was really attractive. So you could do something useful, put together a project, continue in scholarship at a time when the world had kind of ground to a halt, and you know, not just sitting still, but actually doing something useful. So those two things came together, the intellectual interest in these characters who were kind of underneath the law and lurking in the shadows, with the practical desire to, you know, keep active at a time when a lot of things are just being kind of set aside.
So Timothy Hemis, why the scoundrels? I mean, it's pretty obvious, the so-called founding fathers, George Washington, etc., obviously had, you know, shaped the nation. But you're saying these other folks also shaped the nation, I guess.
Yeah, you know, the concept of the scoundrel is, you know, someone that's notorious, it's out for personal interest. Kind of, I think of the Han Solo character from Star Wars, right? And what I kept finding is these folks were doing things contrary to the virtue of the era, the things that we've come to learn about the founding fathers and, you know, come to appreciate. But there's way more than, you know, there's a lot of the founding generation, so to speak. It's not just the founding fathers that are there. And so picking apart, like the idea of, like, for example, James Wilkinson, he was one of the highest ranking generals. And he's later on, we find out after he passes on that he's a Spanish spy. And like, that has always been an intriguing story to me, but I didn't know how to put it together. And I kept noticing that there were so many of these types of people. Maybe they weren't all spies, but they were, you know, land speculators or just criminals in some cases, or corrupt politicians like William Blunt. And so there's many men that don't appear in this work, or they appear on the fringes that probably should get a chapter, but you could, you know, the volume, you could have a volume two, so to speak. There's so many. So we had to pick and choose who to put in.
I wonder if we could maybe talk in specifics here for a little bit before we pull out again for overall meaning. I don't know, Timothy Hemis, you wrote the chapter on Aaron Burr in this volume. He's a little better known, right? He shot Alexander Hamilton. I mean, we all know that. Tell me a little bit about what else he got up to.
So the way I approached the chapter in Aaron Burr was actually, I have done research on one of the key witnesses against Aaron Burr, George Morgan, who I lump in as a scoundrel. You might even probably call maybe a good scoundrel. I don't know. There's a question mark there. There's room for interpretation because he does what's right for the country at the time. But that doesn't always happen in his entire life. He was a businessman, and so he made a lot of questionable decisions. But he does become he's a staunch Jeffersonian, and, you know, he is a key witness against Aaron Burr. And so I really look at kind of the court case, because it becomes almost a circus in itself that the entire country's following. And I remember, you know, when I took an undergrad class, you got maybe 5 minutes on the Aaron Burr conspiracy. It was just a blip on the radar. And I was like, no, this needs more. And so that adds into the conversation. And I think there's, you know, a very important part of that early republic to kind of show that the early republic was fragile.
He got up a private militia.
Yeah.
Right. And his motives were a little unclear, but it could have been to, you know, break away.
He recruits at least, and I say at least because there's others, nine military officials, whether it's Navy, Marines, or the Army, and he's recruiting these officers. Now, I don't, in the chapter, I don't get into that. He's actively recruiting these folks. He's recruiting a lot of frontiersmen, that there's kind of an east-west kind of divide. And when I say east-west, I know you're in Utah. We're talking Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania, Ohio is the West. And so that there's a disparity between there, and that's also riling up emotions. And so it could have easily been a civil war.
And then, as you mentioned, you concentrated on the court case. He went on trial for treason.
Yeah.
This was very partisan, right? He had ardent supporters.
Oh, he absolutely had hardened supporters. And there was people that showed up in Richmond that we're willing to go duel over this. I mean, there's all sorts of things that are going on. Like Richmond was the hotbed of the area. Like I said, it was a circus in the courtroom and in Richmond itself.
And I won't ruin this. I won't ruin the story. You have to go. Go read the book. But he gets a break, and who's assigned as his judge? So there's parallels to today. I won't lean out too much, but I will mention it as we go through. There are some definite parallels to today. So David Head, is any figure really stand out to you from this pretty extensive list of scoundrels?
Yeah. So one guy, I just thought, wow. I was just reading the chapters, and then, wow, again, how could he do that? Was William Blount. He is a land speculator in what became Tennessee. He got himself appointed as the territorial governor when that area was organized as the Southwest Territory. People are more familiar maybe with the Northwest Territory and what became Ohio, the Northwest Ordinance. But there was another territory that was organized, the Southwest Territory, at the same time in the late 18th century. So he got himself appointed as the territorial governor, basically just flat out lied to Washington and the other leaders in the federal government that he was going to do this, you know, as an act of public service. But he got this government position so that he could do things like defraud veterans from the American Revolution. I mean, just actually forging certificates and showing up with them and saying, no, this is my land, not all this other land that you're claiming. He used his position as governor to cheat Native Americans out of their land in various treaties. You know, he used his power as the governor to pick out what the choicest parcels of land were. And all along the way, our author of that chapter, Chris Magra, he's found quotes where Blount isn't hiding this. He writes letters to his brother, who's in the scheme with him, saying, "Yeah, we'll make something up. I'll find somebody to testify to commit perjury for us. It'll be fine. Okay, don't worry about it." So just coming right out and saying, "We're going to do any work, any angle, do anything possible to get this land for us," and he ends up with, I mean, over 1 million acres of land, just an enormous tract of land throughout what would become Tennessee. Now, the really interesting, a bigger part of Blount's story is the way that, you know, he's not just a land speculator, a thief or something. He's actually fundamental to Tennessee becoming a state. He really pushes Tennessee statehood forward, partly by getting all this land under his control and then recruiting settlers to come over from North Carolina. Right? He has it all in one big piece that he can then divide up to people. Also, he's instrumental in pushing for Tennessee to become a state, because there's a point at which he finds it advantageous to have statehood rather than having to report to the federal government. Right, there could be more control over the state in local hands. So really, without him, without this scoundrel, Tennessee would not have become what it became. Its path to statehood, eventually it would have been settled as a state, but the particular path that it took was something that the scoundrel Blount really put together. And without him, the story turns out very differently.
And I guess that's real life, right? In our generation, we've got you know, saints and scoundrels as well, and they each have an effect. So David Head, Blount becomes the first member of Congress to be expelled. He has some ignominious firsts, right? He's the first senator to be impeached.
Yes, he becomes a U.S. senator when he leaves behind once the territory becomes a state, in a state government, they can elect U.S. senators. He's one of the first U.S. senators to represent Tennessee. And then he also becomes the first senator to be impeached. He is involved in a kind of land scheme with British operatives in order to encourage. It's not exactly clear what he has planned. That's one of the challenges of these scoundrels. It's not always clear what they're up to. But it seemed to involve inciting the British to gain control over some American territory as a way to clear out some opposition for Blount to acquire that land. And the British were into this because they wanted to kind of hem in the United States from expanding further. So that comes to light, and yes, he becomes the first senator to be impeached. So another, people who know like kind of nitty gritty of the national story and the institution of Congress may have heard of that story. But that was just the latest in a long line of swindles that Blunt was involved in.
And I think to date, the only senator to be impeached, right? Because his case was used to say, well, the senators don't get impeached.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. Timothy Hemis, I want you to maybe talk about this idea of this goes beyond, and this is a point that you make. We go beyond the founding fathers to the founding generation, which includes all types, right?
Yep. Yeah, this concept of the founding generation is something that, the founding fathers is turned into a hagiography of individuals, Ben Franklin, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and you would even throw in Alexander Hamilton with the latest play, right? You have this, magnetism that's drawn to that, but there's other folks that are right there next to these folks. I keep coming back to this guy named George Morgan, who was a merchant in Philadelphia, who was a land speculator and then the key witness against Burr. But George Morgan was, in a land speculating scheme with Ben Franklin and, knew him very personally. So there's a lot of these close connections, and we think the world is so big, and it really is small, right? Even today, but it was even smaller back then. And so that's why I keep coming to this generation, because it's all these different folks from different, classes, all that, that they're part of the founding generation, and their experiences help shape the Republic, good, bad, and indifferent.
Yeah, that's something I wanted to jump in on too, because it's kind of obvious once you start thinking about it, but it's sort of not a point we often think about the way history is remembered and taught in school, is that obviously there's more than a half dozen important people in the 1780s, 1790s, right? The United States has several million in population. It's an enormous number of people, and they all have different backgrounds and different experiences, different ways of life. It's not just the six or seven that we remember as the big names. And also, if you think about how politicians operate today, they have enormous networks, right? That's one of the things that gets you noticed as a politician. You're good with people and bringing people together and remembering who they are and all that kind of thing. That's what you need to rise in politics, is a network of support. Well, politicians in the 18th century have that too. And there are all these lesser known kind of more minor figures that we don't remember, but were important at the time. So people that the major politicians were connected to, okay, who could bring them information, who could deliver their letters and all that kind of thing, keep their secrets at a time when information didn't move very quickly. So if you look at, for example, one of the things I like to do with my students is if you look at the people who signed the Declaration of Independence, or even better, who signed the Constitution. You know some of the names, like Washington, Franklin signed the Constitution, but most of those guys, nobody's ever heard of. And they're doing one of the most important things in the country's history. Well, that just goes to show you it's a whole generation, not just the big names. It's even these minor figures who were important in their communities and their states at the time, but for whatever reason, have not been remembered in the future. So then you can easily see how you have people of all different kind of backgrounds. Those who are virtuous, who we remember and we like to emulate, and then there are our scoundrels who obviously don't want to emulate, but they were the ones who, everybody else who we remember is kind of playing off of. They're there at the same time doing similar things. So, so it's kind of an obvious point once you, notice it. Like, oh, yeah, of course there are hundreds of prominent national politicians and thousands of state politicians. But we tend to have that, it needs to be pointed out. We tend to forget that when we only focus on a half dozen prominent names.
Timothy Hemis, before we go to break here shortly, You know, reputations fluctuate as well. I mean, there are those figures who are scoundrels and were scoundrels then and are considered scoundrels now. But there are those whose reputations have revived. Alexander Hamilton, for example, owes a big debt of thanks to Lin-Manuel Miranda and perhaps Ron Chernow, mm-hmm. right?
So the concept of scoundrel, you know, hasn't really changed, but how we interpret these folks has. You know, for example, Alexander Hamilton, he's kind of gotten more spotlight, add him into the figure. Aaron Burr is one that maybe deserves more, but he has gotten more attention. I mean, if we remember the 90s Got Milk commercial, like that's probably where a lot of people heard of Aaron Burr, and the Alexander Hamilton duel was a TV commercial from the 90s. And then launch into the musical Hamilton, Aaron Burr's there. But the musical doesn't go into all the intrigue that goes on afterwards, right? With his adventure into the West. And that's something that ties most of these figures together is the frontier, the borderlands, the American borderlands, and the ability to try to carve out a piece of your own stake in that area. So yeah, there's opportunity to reinvestigate those.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's take a break next. We are talking with the editors of a forthcoming book. Timothy Hammes is Assistant Professor of History at Texas A&M University, Central Texas. David Head is Associate Lecturer of History at University of Central Florida and a Distinguished Faculty Fellow in History at Kentucky Wesleyan College. And they're editors for a volume coming out in December. It's called A Republic of Scoundrels, the Schemers, Intriguers, and Adventurers Who Created a New American Nation. We'll hear about some of these, others of these scoundrels, after the break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We are talking with the editors of an interesting upcoming book. It's called A Republic of Scoundrels, the Schemers, Intriguers, and Adventurers Who Created a New American Nation. We're very familiar with the founding fathers, such as George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, Thomas Jefferson, etc. But many others in the founding generation also helped shape the nation. Some of these were scoundrels, quite frankly. We're talking about them on the program today, and we're talking with the editors. Timothy Hammes is Assistant Professor of History, Texas A&M University, Central Texas, and David Head is Associate Lecturer of History at University of Central Florida and Distinguished Faculty Fellow in History at Kentucky Wesleyan College. So I want to start with David Head on this segment. In your conclusion, you write the conclusion, you ask a question which I'll pose to you. Why were there so many scoundrels in the early republic? And so Professor Hammes provided one of the answers, I think, just before the break. The frontier kind of produces or attracts self-interested, euphemistically calling these, or you could call them scoundrels. So why were there so many scoundrels in the early republic?
Yes, I think that's one of the key questions to ponder, right? What was it about this time that opens things up for all these guys? And I think really it is two things that come together. It's the frontier and the borderlands between the United States and Spain. And as Tim mentioned, this is what they call the West at the time. So this is Ohio, Kentucky, Tennessee, Louisiana. So away from the eastern seaboard where the cities of the time were. And this is an area where, you know, men who had dreamed of having their own farms or lands or larger farms than they had ever could have in the eastern part of the country. All of a sudden, with the British and their Native American allies neutralized, that area is relatively open. And if you know you wanted your main chance, this is the time to go grab it. The other key factor, I think, is kind of the uncertainty of the post-revolutionary period in terms of politics and just what the laws are and who's in charge. The American Revolution, it obviously ends British control, but what's going to replace that is uncertain. We have this period in the 1780s where there is the Articles of Confederation government. And that is a form of government that's very state-centered. So the central government is really there to just kind of coordinate the war efforts, fight the British, coordinate actions amongst the states. Otherwise, states are kind of left on their own to do their own thing. You know, who's really in charge? If the state wants to promote, if they want to promote settlement in the West, then they can do it on their own, regardless of what a national policy is. Even when the Constitution comes in at the end of the 1780s, right? How does this actually work? Is it going to be stronger and more enforceable than the Articles of Confederation ever was? If you are want to do something on the West, the Western part of the country that's far from the seat of power, you know, who's going to stop you? You're weeks away from anybody else, the authority figure. Okay, you can just go and try and do it. So that's another factor. A third factor I just thought of here while I was talking is the kind of foreign policy, foreign affairs angle, and how precarious the United States is. There are foreign agents, especially with the Spanish, that share a border with the United States, who would like to see the United States taken down a peg. The United States fought against, Spain fought with the French against Britain during the American Revolution. Never a formal ally of the United States, but we're on the same side. We had the same enemy. And that was fine in taking the British down. Okay, but the idea that a monarchy in Spain wants to share this long border in North America with an anti-monarchy republic, well, that's a little iffy for the future. So there's Spanish agents like Don Diego Gardoqui, who would like to encourage problems in the United States, frankly, who would like to kind of separate some states from the rest of the country, possibly. Again, to kind of diminish the United States and its power in North America. So you put all those things together, the foreign affairs angle, how it's in the interest of some foreign powers to cause trouble for the United States. The uncertainty of the new form of government under the Articles of Confederation and then following under the Constitution. And the fact that with Britain taken off the board and with their support for Native Americans diminished, there's more opportunity for men who want to go grab something to go ahead and grab it.
Timothy Hammett, anything you'd like to say about this?
Yeah, you know, following up on what David was saying about kind of the foreign interests. For example, you know, Gardoqui is working in the 1780s, right at the time of the fall of the Articles of Confederation, with people like George Morgan and James Wilkinson to either create a buffer state or to, like, for example, in the case of Wilkinson, to separate Kentucky from the young republic. And there's Americans that are willing to side with the Spanish because the Republic is in such flux. Like, people are starting to hedge their bets. And there's a bunch of Americans that are willing to go with the Spanish. And George Morgan in 1788-1789 has the New Madrid, in present-day New Madrid, Missouri, where he goes to set up a Spanish colony on the western side of the Mississippi River for the Spanish. And this was supposed to be settled by American expats, essentially. That gets a little teased in the book. It's for another project, but those are the types of things that are happening in the 1780s, the James Wilkinson kind of Kentucky issue. So Spain is an active player, and Gardoqui, Don Diego Gardoqui, which Tyson Reeder wrote the chapter on, is fascinating because it's showing how he went from kind of a friend to kind of not so friendly, a scoundrels, you know, in an international setting.
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on the Spanish part of that. That's one of the surprising things that comes out of the work is how important Spain was to American foreign affairs in the early republic. Of course, we think of Britain, right? Because the American Revolution is fought against Britain, and then the War of 1812 was against Britain. You might think, well, that was the chief rival of the United States, and it was a big rival. But the Spanish are so important because of that shared border in North America, and just what that would eventually become wasn't at all clear in the 1780s, 1790s, and into the early 19th century. So the U.S. relations with Spanish America is just comes out of this book, and it's probably something that will surprise readers.
Timothy Hammes, you want to tell me about a little bit more about James Wilkinson, This is a fascinating figure, a general for the U.S., but suspected of being in league with Spain.
Yeah. So James Wilkinson was a general. He fought in the Revolutionary War and moved up the ranks. Took some time off after the war and was dealing with, you know, the whole Kentucky separation thing with Spain. And that's where his, in 1788, 1789, is when he gets that connection with the Spanish. And he never loses that. And he's always intriguing with the Spanish. But he is always leery of the optics. And like, for example, when the whole Burr conspiracy gets shaken down, he's one of the ones to flip on Burr and writes an affidavit on December 26, 1806, stating that, you know, I went in to see what Burr was doing because I had suspicions of him, and then, you know, testified against him in written form. But he's always trying to save face, whether it's to save his own skin, to keep his cover from being blown. We know that after he dies, there is a connection. He is known as Agent 13 and is a Spanish spy, but it's always suspected by his rivals, but it was never proved during his lifetime. His life would make a great movie.
Yeah. Yeah. We'll suggest that. Maybe you guys can write the screenplay. So Timothy Hammes, you ask a question in your introduction, which I'll pose to you. What does the existence of a man like Wilkinson say about the new American nation?
It talks about kind of the influx or the instability of the young republic. Like, we think about, you know, we have this vision, even today, I would suspect, that we have this vision that the United States is a strong republic. But there could be, it's a lot more fragile than we suspect, especially in that early stages. And Wilkinson is there for his own self. And as, you know, our contributor, Sam Watson, you know, suggests, you know, maybe he's truly an American. Like, he's all these different things. He's actually an opportunist. So,
David Head, who else would you like to highlight? There's a quite list of scoundrels.
So these guys, Wilkinson is kind of the thread that ties everything together. You know, we're like, comes up again and again. We're like, oh, of course it was Wilkinson. Of course they're targeting him. Of course he had a role to play in this. He was in everywhere. A figure I'd never heard of before this book was a guy in Texas named Philip Nolan. He's really interesting. He's one of these people, you know, he's remembered locally in some part of Texas, possibly. But he's one of these guys that played an important role at the time, but has just been completely forgotten over time. Philip Nolan was a horse trader. So he would, he had this a business where he was operating out of Louisiana. And he would travel into Spanish Texas, okay? So across an international border, and he would find horses. Sometimes he would trade with local Native Americans for the horses, and sometimes he would go and capture them himself. And you just imagine that, right? I'm going to ride into Texas, and I'm going to rope some horses and bring them back, and the whole thing is going to take 6 months or a year or so, right? And who does that? So that was really interesting. I will admit, this is a kind of funny story. It took me a while to realize why he was going for horses. Somehow, in my mind, I had assumed that he was capturing horses to race them. But no, of course, they were going to sell them to work on the farms. Like, oh, of course, right? You see what a 21st century suburbanite thinks horses are for, versus what a 19th century farmer, right, thinks what horses are for. So along the way, because he was crossing an international border, Spanish officials are very suspicious. Like, what is this guy up to? He's an American. And the Spanish were always afraid that Americans operating in the borderlands there, they weren't there just for, you know, merchant purposes or trading or horses, or whatever. They were agents of the United States government who were trying to gain a foothold and, you know, lead the way for the United States to invade their territory. That tended to be the assumption of Spanish officials for everybody. And no one kind of gets caught up in the middle of this. And he's eventually killed by the Spanish in Texas. And the way he's remembered, kind of strangely, is he's remembered by Texans kind of as the way that the Spanish imagined he was. He's kind of remembered as a force of bringing the United States Anglo-Americans into Texas, which is what the Spanish always suspected he was doing. It's not really what he was doing, but that comes the way that he's remembered and then celebrated later on as a kind of a figure at the forefront of the American movement into Texas, which is a strange way to remember him the way his enemies thought of him and then celebrate him for it. So it gives you some idea of the complexities of how these figures are remembered over time after their deaths.
That kind of is a nice segue to the next one of it. So, Timothy Hemis, I'd like you to talk to me about Matthew Lyon. He doesn't have a chapter in the book, I don't think, but this is an example of someone who's a scoundrel to one side of the divide, right? not both.
He does have a chapter.
Oh, he does. He does. Yeah. Okay.
And Shira Lurie wrote that chapter. And Matt Lyons is one of these figures that is kind of very outspoken and kind of very just blunt in a lot of ways. And his followers, his constituents love him for that, right? However, he upsets the other party and they lob grenades at him. And essentially, you know, he's eventually arrested and runs for office from prison and is elected. So I know maybe David can help out a little more, fill in more of that, but.
Right, so Lyons was, he was a congressman from Vermont. He was an immigrant from Ireland. And he tended to be, so he's a Republican, and he tended to be everything that the rival Federalists feared about what was going wrong with the new country's politics. Someone who comes from abroad, so doesn't have a long history being rooted in the country the way many of the Federalists did. As Tim mentioned, he's outspoken and blunt in attacking the Federalist administration. He's not playing by the rules the way that gentlemen are supposed to play by the rules. And worst part for the Federalists is that he gains power by doing this. He's not shunned by the people automatically. So this is kind of Lyon's career is one of these things where Federalists say, uh-oh, what have we created in this new country that it empowers people like this? What's going to happen in the future if this guy, okay, this rabble rouser, is the future of American politics? Our country is not going to last. But yet, in the long run, we look back at this and say, yes, this is Democratic politics. He represents the people of his district, and they reward him because they think he's doing a good job by entrusting him with power. That's the way democracy is supposed to work. I think some of the Federalists are like, yeah, that's the problem. That's the way democracy works. And we're not going to have a long future if that is what the country's political system is going to be. So that's where Lyons is a particularly interesting character. He has a very famous incident where he gets into a brawl on the floor of the house there. And I think he and his opponent, they pick up the fireplace tools, the poker that are in the room there, and they start trying to hit each other with that. So kind of brawling on the floor of the Congress was something that happened in the early 19th century with Lyons.
Well, this one's one that I definitely thought parallels to today, potential parallels. He was in jail and ran for re-election. Yeah, you know, we don't have to lean on that, but you can make your own obvious parallels to possibilities for today. Well, let's take another break. When we come back, we'll have a final segment with the editors of this forthcoming book called Republic of Scoundrels. And we're talking with David Head and Timothy Hemis. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We have about 7 or 8 minutes left. In this discussion, a very interesting book is coming out in December. Republic of Scoundrels is the title, the subtitle, The Schemers, Intriguers, and Adventurers Who Created a New American Nation. And the editors of this volume are with us. David Head is Associate Lecturer of History at University of Central Florida and a Distinguished Faculty Fellow in History at Kentucky Wesleyan College. Timothy Hemis is an Assistant Professor of History at Texas A&M University, Central Texas. So I'll direct this to David Head. I think it's the first chapter. I mean, it's an obvious one. You would think there would be no shades of gray here. Benedict Arnold. I mean, you know, the traitor, right? Total scoundrel. I think we know pretty much the history. I wonder how did Benedict Arnold shape the nation?
Right. So Benedict Arnold is an interesting case because, as you mentioned, I mean, this is the clear bad guy, right? There must have been no good in him. But as the author of that chapter, James Kirby Martin, a veteran a scholar of the American Revolution, points out, Arnold certainly was a traitor. There's no doubt about that. But the way he came to his treason was interesting. It was in large part due to the frustration he felt with dealing with other men who, if not as extreme as Arnold's became, were certainly self-interested, lacking in the kind of public virtue that they all claimed to possess. So Arnold was kind of one scoundrel among many. Certainly he went much further and was much more damaging than others were. But the men he served alongside, they're out to vindicate their own reputation, to blame Arnold when battles don't go as expected. When there's a great victory at Saratoga, Battle of Saratoga, for example, they are very, very happy to take the credit away from Arnold, even though Arnold served very admirably at that battle. Arnold is one of the most talented generals the United States has in the Continental Army. And certainly if he had not turned to the British, he would be celebrated alongside the other major figures of the war. And Arnold grows, this frustration just grows and grows until the point where he believes that the war is lost, that the Americans are so selfish that they're never going to be able to defeat the British. And Arnold comes to think that he would like to try to end the war one way or another to prevent the further loss of life on both sides. And he comes to believe that the best way to do this is not by winning a victory for the United States, but by giving the United States over to the British, helping the British win, end the war faster, because that will help both help the United States long run by preventing further deaths. What Arnold doesn't see, and this is a key insight from Martin, is that Arnold's treason will help to inspire the Americans and revive their war effort so that they become more devoted to the cause in reaction to his treason. And that kind of propels the Americans forward towards, redoubling their efforts to fight against Britain. So Arnold's larger contribution to American history is through his negative example, but also by his treason revives the war effort. So it's an interesting question. Could the United States have won without Arnold's treason? They would have had Arnold on the American side as a leader in the war, but maybe not the same inspiration to redouble their efforts fighting against Britain if he hadn't committed that act of treason. This is a great example of how complex people are, how complex events are. There's no sort of straight line towards victories, all these things coming together. And historians love this stuff. And I hope that readers love this kind of stuff too, because you really get to see just how complicated life is for everyone.
We just have a couple of minutes left, so maybe give you a minute to kind of sum up what. So, Timothy Hemis, what's the big takeaway from this, do you think?
I think, getting a fuller picture of what the American Revolution and the early Republic was like through the lenses of these individuals, these scoundrels, getting a fuller picture of the history. And these are individuals that are not always talked about in your, history US 1 class or your U.S. American history classes. You probably won't hear those. And so this adds into that fuller picture. And I hope our readers get that and enjoy that.
So David Head, I just want to quote you from your conclusion. You talk about the founding fathers. The America they built and the America the scoundrels built were the same country. Your takeaway from this.
Yes, yeah, so I just want to echo what Tim said. This is really about broadening the cast of characters who we remember and really kind of appreciating the complexity of the past, where it is the same country. We're certainly not trying to tear down the founders or tarnish them or anything like that, but just to realize that these other people are there too and they're interacting with each other. And that's part of the American story as well. And it's the same country. I hope everyone gets a fuller appreciation for just how complex life was in the 18th century.
Well, we'll leave it there. Interesting discussion. The book's coming out in December. You can pre-order it, I'm sure, and look forward to that. The book is A Republic of Scoundrels, and the editors have been with us. David Head is an associate lecturer of history at University of Central Florida and a distinguished faculty fellow in history at Kentucky Wesleyan College. And Timothy Hemmes is assistant professor of history at Texas A&M University Central Texas. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having us here.
Thank you, Tom. Have a good one.
Thank you.